Pharmacist Elizabeth Roddick is here, as always, around about this time each week. Hello.
Hello, Stephen.
How are you today?
Very well, thanks.
Excellent. Well, I know you've got a couple of things you want to talk about today. We thought we'd kick things off with a conversation that's been in the news a bit around menopause. Lots about this in the news recently. What's the best treatment?
That's a very complex question, Stephen.
I bet it is.
Because, in fact, some women don't need any treatment. If you're finding someone out there, a woman out there who's got a lot of symptoms, then I suggest it's worthwhile having a chat with your GP. They'll be able to advise on HRT. Now, that's hormone replacement therapy. And that does come in lots of different forms, tablets, patches, gels, creams. There's also a cream that goes inside intravaginally. HRT does carry a slight increased risk of cancer, so that has to be weighed against having an effective treatment. Now, as far as alternatives are concerned, people are interested in that as well if they don't want to go down the HRT route. Omega-3 is a useful supplement, which incidentally there's some research for prevention of AMD, age-related macular degeneration, so I think that's of interest maybe to people out there. Also, herbs, sage, for example, will help with hot flushes. You may be able to, I think, get some advice on alternatives, maybe from your local pharmacist if he or she has a real interest in it.
Okay. Well, lots, as you say, and it's a very complex answer, but that will help. So hopefully help a few people with the answer to that one. Let's talk a bit about the other topic that you wanted to talk about this week on the programme, and that is a link that's been in the news about vitamin D and asthma, and it could actually help worsen or not worsen asthma, which actually could be really interesting. Well, let's go through that, but we'll start perhaps with asthma itself. Is that where you struggle breathing? Is that what?
Yeah, that's right. It's a long-term lung disease, and the inflammation causes the airways to narrow. It can cause chest tightness, shortness of breath, coughing, particularly at night and also early morning. It has to be managed well, because if you have exacerbations, that means worsening of the symptoms. And if it's not controlled, it can cause hospitalisation and even death.
But what causes it?
Well, one reason is perhaps as a result of allergies. For example, if you've got rhinitis, now that's a runny nose, then that can in fact lead to asthma. So it's really got to be controlled. Parents passing it on to children, and if you have a respiratory infection as a child or contract certain of the viral infections in infancy, then that immune system, in fact, can be really harmed in terms of developing, and that it means you can end up with an asthma.
And do you treat it mainly with inhalers?
Yes, that's one of the most important things we do, is to make sure that asthmatic patients get the best use of their medication, and that's inhalers. For example, emphasising the regular use of the steroid inhaler, sometimes called the brown inhaler, but there are so many inhalers about now, they're all sorts of colours. And also to make sure they're using the inhaler properly, their technique. If you don't use your inhaler well, then you don't get all the medication right into the lung. So as well as inhalers, there are also tablets added in at night, or during a bad spell, you may need to take very large doses of a steroid.
Okay. Now, let's talk a little bit about vitamin D. It has a lot of different functions in the body.
I think most people, Stephen, know about the importance of vitamin D for bones and the absorption of calcium. Severe vitamin D deficiency can result in rickets in babies and young children, and that's bone softening. But vitamin D has a role in the immune system. There's been research showing if vitamin D levels are adequate, that can reduce respiratory tract infections. And better to have a higher vitamin D level in the body if you have cancer. I think that's important. The latest guidance is that most people should take a vitamin D supplement, certainly through the winter.
So the idea is that the research that we've heard about, at least, means that if you take vitamin D, it could actually help people who have severe asthma.
Yeah, it was an international group of researchers, and the study was published in The Lancet. And it was a review of trials that compared a vitamin D supplement and a placebo, in other words, an inactive sugar tablet. There have been previous studies looking at this, but the difference this time was finding out the level of the vitamin D the person had in their body to start with, and did that have a bearing on the asthma episodes? And because it was a double-blind trial, no one knew whether they were taking vitamin D or not. There were 978 people in the study were given either an injection of 100,000 international units, that's given every 2 months, or a tablet containing 500 to 2,000 international units, that's per day, or a mixture of both. And the study lasted from 15 weeks to a year. Now, the levels of vitamin D in the sample range from undetectable, which I'm afraid a lot of people in UK have undetectable levels, which is serious, to 187 nanomoles per litre, which is quite high. And in this study, they took 25 as the cut-off point for vitamin D deficiency. And they found that vitamin D supplementation meant that there was a 26% reduction in asthma episodes that needed participants to take, as I was saying about the steroid treatment. So there's that reduction. But the result was based on only 92 people who were deficient. And most importantly, at the end of the trial, there were no adverse effects reported from vitamin D supplementation. The strength of the study was that it looked at good randomised controlled trials, but with only 92 people deficient, it's probably too soon to recommend that people with asthma take vitamin D. But I know there are other studies where it has shown a benefit. And as I said already about respiratory tract infections, that can be very serious if you're asthmatic to get one of these infections. I suggest it would be worthwhile supplementing, certainly through the winter, at least 400 international units. That's what's recommended at the moment. But again, looking at other studies around the world, they've used much higher doses. So get some, I suppose, advice and just about adverse effects. I don't see any problem in perhaps taking more, but certainly the government guidelines, and I think everyone should be taking it, is 400 international units.
Okay. I mean, we love having you here because we can talk about so many different issues. The next one that I wanted to bring up was a rather interesting story about regularly skipping breakfast. Now, we all know that's not a great thing, but we are learning that it could be causing a hardening of the arteries. So, first of all, the question is, what does that actually mean? What does hardening of the arteries mean?
It's a condition called atherosclerosis. And this is a build-up of fatty deposits known as plaque. You've probably heard about that on your teeth. But that's in the arteries, and that's within the artery, the lumen in the artery, which of course is quite serious.
So it's to do with that, and that is linked to not eating breakfast or skipping breakfast.
Yeah, it was a collaboration. The researchers were Spanish and US, and some of the other headlines, such as skipping breakfast, triggered the same energy response as the body is starvation. That was another headline. Certainly wasn't proved in this. Another headline suggested people were not taking breakfast to lose weight. Again, I think some of the papers were picking up different aspects of this, which wasn't proved in the study. It was about people who didn't eat breakfast and whether that was more likely. Were these people more likely to have unhealthy lifestyles? I think that's one of the things they found. They used over 4,000 adults, and they were aged between 40 and 54. And they worked at the headquarters of Santander Bank in Madrid, which is quite interesting. And the participants were screened, and those who already had heart and kidney disease were, of course, excluded. But those who were morbidly obese as well, they were excluded. That's a body mass index of over 40. Now, the questionnaire divided the participants into those who had high energy breakfast, and that's more than 20% of their daily energy at that time, right down to skipping breakfast. And they said that was less than 5% of their daily energy intake. And that would just be something like an orange juice or a coffee, which many people take. Mm. And to assess the buildup of the fatty deposits, they used ultrasound and also checked the amount of calcium in the walls of the arteries. And the amount of calcium also leads to the fat being deposited in the arteries. The results were that only 3% skipped breakfast, 69% had a low-energy breakfast, and 25% high energy. Now, those who didn't take a breakfast were more likely to be male, smokers, tried to lose weight and have a more unhealthy diet, such as increased in calories in animal proteins and cholesterol. Also lower in fats and carbohydrates. So 63% showed a sign of atherosclerosis condition, in other words, the hardening of the arteries. Unfortunately, like a lot of these headlines, we can't say if the headline is true. I think it's more about, are these people, those in the study who have skipped breakfast, are they anyway taking the wrong foods, unhealthy eating habits, smoking also in probably some of the group? I think that's actually more important than skipping breakfast. So stopping smoking and eating more healthily is certainly more important.
But you're telling us that NICE has brought out some new guidelines around preventing excessive weight gain.
Yes, it's about encouraging people to make changes in line with existing advice. It's the usual story about increasing physical activity, eating more healthily. They talk about energy balance, and that means the energy from all the food and drink matches energy used for all bodily functions, physical activity. It's a balancing act, Stephen.
People with type 2 diabetes should save carbs for last in a meal. Explain that.
This was about eating bread, for example, at the end of the meal. I don't think many of us do that.
No, I don't.
And that, what that means is the stomach would empty more slowly. Protein and vegetables would be digested first. And it's all about preventing a glucose spike. The researchers were from the US and they were studying type 2 diabetes. And I know some of the press got mixed up, talked about type 1 diabetes as well. Now, these people are quite different, the type 1s. They need insulin injections. They need to have a tight control over their carbohydrates and diet generally. So the study was looking at when the best time was to eat carbohydrates and to keep glucose levels steady. That's what we want to do. 16 people between 35 and 65 had all been diagnosed with type 2 diabetes within the last 10 years. And they either had to eat carbohydrates first, followed by protein and vegetables 10 minutes later, or the other way around, protein and veg first and the carbohydrates later. And the third group just ate everything together, which I suspect we all do. Mm-hmm. Blood samples were taken before the participants had eaten everything, and also 30 minutes and after 3 hours as well. And what they found was that with carbohydrates, when they were consumed at the end of the meals, insulin levels were 24.8% lower. And also the glucose levels were significant lower as well. There was no difference when everything was eaten together. So first of all, I think we need to look at a much bigger trial to follow up the results in this small trial. We don't know whether it could be only a certain type of person with type 2 diabetes, whether that could make a difference. Also, they didn't measure physical activity. This could have changed results. We know that physical activity can bring down glucose levels. I think the message is eat a healthy diet, keep active in order to keep your blood sugar levels absolutely steady. I think that's the key.
It's all really simple stuff if you think about it, but it's stuff that we just don't do enough of, isn't it? That's the problem.
Hard to do. Yeah. I'm not sure.
It's great to read it and it's great to talk about it, but it's hard to do it. I think that's the problem. Anyway, it's been great hearing from you. Thank you so much for coming in, Elizabeth. Always good to get your view on the big headlines in the health world. Elizabeth Roddick, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Stephen.